May it please the court. My name is Jordan Factor, bar number 38126, and I represent the Kelly parties. This court harmonizes apparently conflicting contractual provisions and declines to adopt an interpretation that would render either one meaningless. The retention provision and the decree may be easily harmonized by concluding that plaintiffs retained all claims against defendant Gordon, but they released any remedy directed at the Virginia property. The construction that plaintiffs urge and that the trial court adopted, that the decree only resolved those claims directed at Ms. Kelly's interest in the property, but not Mr. Gordon's interest in the property, renders the decree meaningless. Rule 105A, pursuant to which the decree entered, provides that the trial court shall, in its decree, completely determine the controversy related to the real property. Therefore, the purpose of a decree is to notify third parties, such as prospective purchasers, lenders, and others, that the claims noticed initially in the Liz pendants that seek to impact the real property have been completely determined, and that no further relief will enter impacting the property. Plaintiff's construction would render such a Rule 105A decree meaningless.
Counsel, what do you make of the trial court's language in its July 25th, 2012 order specifying that the court will retain and reserve jurisdiction over claims by O'Connell's against Kelly pending further action by the plaintiffs? What additional rights did it give the court vis-a-vis the litigation, or why is that language even there if what you're saying is that basically Ms. Kelly was out of the case at that point?
So the court retained jurisdiction over Ms. Kelly only because the parties had agreed that the $11,000 equitable lien that they negotiated for over 9 hours at JAG would be liquidated after a year if the property had not sold. And the court retained jurisdiction over Ms. Kelly only to ensure enforcement of that provision. However, the case against her was administratively closed, and all claims against her were stayed. The plaintiffs removed Ms. Kelly from the certificate of service after the settlement and ceased serving her with documents and pleadings in the case, certainly did not provide her with any witness list or exhibit list in advance of the damages hearing. And so the only purpose for the trial court's retained jurisdiction was because the settlement was contingent on the liquidation of that $11,000 equitable lien. Now, the construction that plaintiffs urge is not only contrary to the function of a Rule 105A decree, it's also contrary to the language of this particular decree, which adjudicates the Liz pendants and resolves all claims in the civil action, not just those against Ms. Kelly, but in the civil action that assert any right, title, or interest in the Virginia property. Anyone reviewing the real property records for the Virginia property would conclude that no further relief is going to enter on this property. And that was precisely the party's intent when they stipulated the entry of this particular decree as a material term of their settlement agreement. Therefore, the trial court's subsequent imposition of a $75,000 equitable lien was directly contrary to the party's unambiguous intent in settling this case.
Mr. Factor, wouldn't you agree, though, that In looking at the complaint and the history behind this case, it seems that the purpose of the case was to ultimately get a lien on this property, trace the funds from these other sales to the Virginia property, get a lien on that so that the prior money judgment could be satisfied. It wasn't to obtain just another money judgment. Wouldn't that be kind of pointless?
I disagree, Your Honor. First of all, there were multiple properties referred to in the complaint. The Virginia property was only one.
But the other two had been sold. So those were not available, as I take it, to satisfy the judgment. So yes, they're mentioned, but only for purposes of tracing those transactions so that we can take the money that flowed through those transactions to the Virginia property.
That is accurate. However, the plaintiffs did seek money damages. They didn't consider it irrelevant. They made that part of their prayer for relief, and indeed, after settling with Ms. Kelly, they sought and obtained a $130,000 money judgment against Mr. Gordon. So clearly, the plaintiffs believed that a money judgment had value, and they sought it from the beginning, and they pursued it at the end. In addition, they sought to have some relief with respect to the Virginia property. However, they settled with the fraudulent transferee, and after a long day of negotiations, came up with the number $11,000. As an equitable lien against the property, in addition to a $10,000 payment from Ms. Kelly. So they got $10,000 in cash, $11,000 against the property, a $130,000 money judgment against Mr. Gordon, and they were content with that, apparently, at the time of settlement. It was only after Ms. Kelly settled, the case against her was administratively closed, that plaintiffs noticed this for a damages hearing, advised counsel for Ms. Kelly that he need not attend, and then at that hearing pursued additional equitable relief and did so in the form of an ex parte order that they drafted.
Mr. Thatcher, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure I get this question out. I want to make sure I understand your understanding of the decree, the language, the particular decree language you're talking about. Is it your understanding that the decree released all claims that claim any right in the Virginia property, including those claims against Mr. Gordon?
Yes.
So how does that square with the other part of the decree, which says that the claims against Gordon shall proceed or may proceed?
Because all claims could proceed, and all claims that were asserted in the complaint sought forms of relief that did not impact the Virginia property. So, for example, they had a claim for civil conspiracy in which they sought money damages. They had a claim for constructive trust / equitable lien, which is not really a claim, it's a remedy. But in any event, in paragraph 3 of their prayer for relief, they don't even mention the Virginia property as the target of that form of equitable relief. Really, they had two substantive claims in this case: fraudulent conveyance and civil conspiracy. They had three forms of relief that they styled as claims. Declaratory judgment is a claim, accounting, constructive trust, and equitable lien. All the substantive claims that they had asserted against Mr. Gordon could proceed and did proceed and could entitle them to damages and relief without regard to the Virginia property. However, they released any form of relief directed to the Virginia property when they stipulated to a Rule 105A decree whose function is to do precisely that, to completely determine any claim impacting the property and notifying the world through the real property records that this property is not in jeopardy any longer of having relief attached to it. And once the court entered this decree under Rule 105, it was entitled to enter further orders in aid of the decree, is the language of the rule, but not in complete derogation of it. which is what the court did here, which is one of three reasons warranting reversal, and I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Actually, I have a question relating to this 105A decree issue. The court, did not release the list pendants. So if the intent was to resolve finally everything relating to the list pendants, wouldn't that have been done?
No. Rule 105A does not use the word release. The way it is customary for litigants to file a release of Liz pendants as a means of notifying the public that the claims have been resolved. But in fact, the way that Rule 105A contemplates a recordation of notice is not a release of Liz pendants. It's the entry of a decree doing precisely what this decree did, adjudicating the Liz pendants. A court can't really release something. It adjudicates it, and that's what the court did here. It said the Liz pendants is adjudicated and the claims have been resolved. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
May it please the court, Douglas Norbert, 28778, on behalf of the plaintiffs, appellees, Terry and Brenda O'Connell. The appellants largely ignore the 800-pound gorilla in the room. There was a lawsuit which was reduced to a judgment in 2008 against Mr. Gordon. After substantial efforts to collect and enforce that judgment, a fraudulent transfer lawsuit was filed in 2011. In that lawsuit, we specifically referenced the Virginia property. As of the point in time of filing the complaint, we have done significant investigation and determined and traced Mr. Gordon's property into, or his money and property, into that Virginia property. The issue at the point in time with the settlement with Ms. Kelly was the property, Virginia, was in her name, and the loan was in default. That property was going into foreclosure, and all of the equity in the Virginia property was going to be lost. At that time, everyone thought it was about $100,000 worth of equity. It ultimately turned out to be around $70,000 of equity. Ms. Kelly is on title to the Virginia property, but she can't sell it because it's encumbered by our Liz pendants as a result of the fraudulent transfer lawsuit. She can't refinance it because of our Liz pendants. She needs us to allow her to refinance that property or sell, which means we're going to have to do something to deal with the Liz pendants. Well, what do we need from Ms. Kelly? We need her to somehow cash out or preserve that equity. The loan with Merchants Mortgage was in default, the foreclosure was pending, and if she lost that property and went through the foreclosure, guess what? There would be no money anywhere for anyone to recover. So, Mr. Factor is correct. We did go to JAG, and it was a very long day at JAG trying to figure out how to skin this cat. And the ultimate resolution was Ms. Kelly would cap her exposure, her personal exposure for her involvement in the fraudulent transfers at $21,000. Under the terms of the settlement at JAG, Ms. Kelly was required to list that property for sale within 21 days. It was supposed to be listed by August 1, 2012. But there was a concern, and the concern and the issue was, well, what if she can't sell it? If she can't sell it, well, then she's going to need to refinance it. Well, how do we make this happen? Well, first we reserved all the claims against Mr. Gordon. She can't sell it, and she can't refinance it with the Liz pendants. So how do we work out that issue? We reached the settlement agreement with Ms. Kelly where we are going to enter into the settlement agreement, and we are going to have the court decree that the Liz pendants with respect to Virginia has been resolved. Without that decree, this property is not marketable. You can't look at this case in a vacuum, as the appellants would try to do. We have to figure out, why is the settlement structured the way that it was? Why did we need this decree? The whole purpose of the decree and the purpose of this settlement was to make this property marketable so it could either be sold or refinanced to capture the equity.
Counsel, but part of a problem I have is how do we reconcile the what seems to be a very big inconsistency between, on the one hand, the settlement agreement effectively recognizing that Ms. Kelly is the owner of the property, the parties stipulated to that, and then the trial court's later finding at the damages hearing that Mr. Gordon owns the property. To me, those seem completely inconsistent, and I don't know how this court reconciles that.
Sure. Just because the issue of her being the owner in fee simple, we had filed the complaint, and in the complaint we had alleged that Mr. Gordon was the owner of the property. In order to make this property marketable, we recognized that she was the record holder. We used the language that she owned the property in free simple. In fee simple. That does not mean that she owns that property free and clear.
Wait, let's stop you right there.
Sure.
Fee simple absolute is a defined term. Everything I've looked at uses that term synonymously with exclusive ownership unencumbered. Everything I've looked at. I've never heard of a definition of fee simple absolute, which simply means record owner.
Okay.
So fee simple absolute, let me give you an example. If I get a warranty deed from somebody selling me a piece of property, warranting that they're giving me the property in fee simple absolute, and it turns out that there is a claim against the property, even one that's based on a supposed equitable interest, guess what? The warranty's been breached.
And let me respond to that. At the point in time that the decree was issued, saying that Ms. Kelly owned the property in fee simple, it was still encumbered by the merchant's mortgage lien.
But those are liens. Those aren't claims to ownership. Fee simple absolute means, and I've looked at the dictionary, end quote, exclusive ownership, end quote. Those are liens, not claims of ownership.
Right.
And you're saying that you stipulated she owned it.
Right.
And then you went back to the court later when she's out of the case for all practical purposes and said, oh, wait, Mr. Gordon owns it.
Let me put the point on it, because I think you and I are not necessarily in disagreement. The claim against Mr. Gordon and the relief ultimately imposed by Judge Frick was an equitable lien. And the fact that she is title holder does not mean that that property cannot be subject to the liens. It was subject.
Yeah, well, now wait a second. The equitable lien is based upon what she concluded was Mr. Gordon's ownership interest. That's explicit in her findings. She finds that he is the actual owner. I think those are her words. He is the actual owner of the property. And that's why she imposed the lien. That is directly contrary to the concept of fee simple ownership in Ms. Kelly. You can't reconcile the two.
Well,
either she owns it in fee simple absolute or she doesn't.
But Your Honor, in fairness, we settled with Ms. Kelly based upon our understanding of the law, and the judge ruled after the fact and made certain specific findings.
But how can you make that Ms. Kelly's problem?
What?
Yes, you settled on certain terms and you should have known what they meant. That's not Ms. Kelly's problem.
Right, but Your Honor, if you look at all of the documents, they want to take the decree and look at the decree in isolation and look at that language in the decree and focus on the decree. We need to construe all the documents in harmony in light of the context. What's going on here?
Wait a minute. The settlement agreement has a merger clause, okay? We don't go beyond the documents. It has an integration clause. You want us to consider what was in your head at the time. We can't do that. We've got to look at what the document says. Well, all of the documents granted, but what they said.
Well, I think the trial court looked at it and interpreted the documents in light of the court's record and looked at the context. And I think that's reasonable. And if the Court of Appeals, if you determine that you're going to review this de novo, which I think is probably the appropriate standard, I think in your de novo review, you are entitled and should look at the full record of this case. Really, what were we trying to accomplish? And that's what Judge Frick, I think, was pretty astute in recognizing. What were we really trying to do here? Were we really trying to give up everything that we had in this case for $21,000? Now, I know that Ms. Kelly has asserted that this was some sort of a plan or something to trick them or take advantage of them. what Ms. Kelling did. I mean, we were preserving this equity, and everyone was going to make a grab for this equity in this property. Ms. Kelly did it by asserting the homestead exemption, which is one of the other issues that's before the court. One of the issues that I want to talk about is Ms. Kelly talks about the fact that she was denied notice and the opportunity to appear, and this was some sort of an ex parte proceeding, and we didn't give them notice. What had happened is on July 11th, 2012, there was the settlement agreement at JAG, which was reduced to a settlement memorandum. The damages hearing was set on July 16th. We have the hearing set with Judge Frick, where the defendant, Ms. Kelly, indicated that she no longer, her counsel indicated that he was not planning attending the damages hearing. What they don't point out in their reply brief was that after Ms. Kelly exited stage left, Mr. Gordon reappeared stage right. In the court file at 307, you'll see Mr. Gordon filed a forthwith motion to continue the damages here. He retained counsel and showed back up on the scene. In his request to continue the damages hearing, Mr. Gordon specifically requests, in addition, I would request copies of any and all documents, along with the names of any and all persons providing testimony upon which plaintiffs would rely for proving their damages at least 2 weeks in advance of the hearing. This disclosure would allow counsel to examine the documents, endorse rebuttal witnesses as needed, and otherwise prepare for the hearing. Judge Frick had made specific findings of fact throughout the course of this case that Mr. Gordon and Ms. Kelly engaged in a concerted effort to obstruct and prevent discovery in this case. And so while Ms. Kelly is arguing that she's prejudiced because she didn't have notice of this hearing and didn't know that that was going to be the relief sought, what we had is really Ms. Kelly effectively exiting one door and Mr. Gordon coming in the other door. Judge Frick made very detailed findings with respect to their involvement. And specifically, Judge Frick reconsidered this issue multiple times. We have three orders from Judge Frick. We have her initial judgment order. Then we have her order regarding judgment, where she reconsiders the judgment order and reaffirms it. And I don't want to misstate it, but I seem to think in the judgment order is where she described it as an equitable lien and imposed a lien against the property. And I think if you look at the transcript of the proceedings, that's what we requested. We requested to trace Gordon's money or property into the Virginia property, and I seem to recall, I don't want to misstate, that she made a specific finding of an equitable lien there.
Mr. Norbert, if the party's intent was to, I guess, free up the property to be able to realize some money out of it, couldn't the parties have included that as part of the settlement agreement so that there was no misconception or misunderstanding about your client's continued interest in seeking some money from the Virginia property?
To answer your question, I would have to get into our discussions at the settlement conference. Like any settlement, it's a give and take. This is what we could negotiate, and this is what we could reach an agreement on after a full day at JAG. And so, yeah, ideally, I think everybody looking back wishes maybe we would have written things differently and it would be more clear and that we wouldn't be here today. But during the course of the settlement, you negotiate what you think you can get the other side to agree on. And so I think to answer your question, I'd have to go down the explanation of why did we negotiate what we could negotiate, because that's what we could negotiate.
Well, counsel, I'm still hung up on this this idea that you seem to be putting across, that even though the decree says what it says, that she's fee simple, absolute owner of this property, and that the lease pendants is adjudicated to make the property marketable, as you said, it is marketable only if a buyer out there believes that there is clear title. But you're saying, no, we had our fingers crossed, title really wasn't clear. We were going to go back later and muddy up the waters with this equitable lien that was going to be backdated all the way to the list pendants. Well, if I'm a buyer of that property, I'm really upset and I'm starting to sue people.
Let me address that. So the first thing is Judge Frick in her own orders went back and modified the decree. And they want to argue that she doesn't have the ability to go back and modify her orders to reconcile her orders.
Wait a minute. How can she modify something that's stipulated to by the parties? That is expressly part of the settlement agreement.
After their argument, she went back and looked at the decree, and I think the trial court fairly sits in review of its own orders, and she determined that decree was inconsistent with the intent of the parties in the settlement. And as a result of that, through her subsequent orders, she went back and reviewed her decree and said, to the extent my decree is inconsistent, look at the final
judgment. So she determined that something the parties stipulated to was inconsistent with what they agreed to? That's what you're saying.
Well, when her determination was that there was an internal inconsistency in the documents and she needed to reconcile those documents. And she had multiple hearings, entertained several briefs, and addressed that. Because I'm running out of time here, let me change on one other point on your question that you just asked, Your Honor. With respect to our lien claim for Mr. Gordon wasn't going to hit anybody who bought this property. If she sold the property and Joe Schmo came and bought this property, it wasn't going to hit. Because we were taking the risk that once Ms. Kelly cashed it out and had the cash, we would have to chase the money. So our lien claim...
But you couldn't chase it to her. You settled with her.
We would have to chase the money, arguing still that it was Gordon's money or property that Kelly had.
And then I waived the settlement agreement at you because you settled all claims against me arising out of this whole thing. So
only with respect to Ms. Kelly, not with respect. We were still arguing that it was Gordon's money, even if she sold and cashed out.
But you want the money from her.
We want the money wherever we can find it.
So even though you settled with her, you would go after her for the money that she has, claiming that it's somebody else's.
No, Your Honor, we would request that the trial court did what it did and impose a constructive trust or an equitable lien against those proceeds. It didn't matter, because ultimately what happened, Your Honor, is the property was sold. It was a pot of gold. The pot of gold got put into the court registry, and we said to the trial court, that's our money. And the trial court agreed and imposed an equitable lien and ultimately ordered the proceeds be turned over to us. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You've just got right under 4 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the two reasons the parties stipulated that Ms. Kelly was the owner in fee simple absolute of the property. The first is that the form of relief that plaintiffs requested in the complaint was to proceed in two stages. First, they wanted the court to declare that Mr. Gordon and not Ms. Kelly was the equitable owner of the property. And then second, they wanted an equitable lien to attach to all of Mr. Gordon's interest in the property in favor of the plaintiffs. And that was noticed by the Liz Pendants. Therefore, it put the world on notice that ownership of this property was in dispute in this case. By stipulating in the decree that Ms. Kelly was the owner in fee simple absolute, it reflected the party's intent that the plaintiffs would no longer continue to seek that form of relief that they had requested in the complaint, and they were notifying the world that they were not doing so any longer. And that was important for the second reason that they included that in the decree, is as recited in the settlement agreement, Ms. Kelly needed to either find a purchaser for the property or refinance the property quickly because it was in immediate jeopardy of foreclosure. And so she needed the world to know that she was the fee simple owner in absolute, and they could deal with her, they could lend to her, they could buy from her without fear that what in fact happened was going to happen. And the court was going to impose an additional equitable lien on the property. That's why that language is in there. And I'd like to point out in addition that in the ex parte order that plaintiffs crafted, they provided that a receiver was to be immediately appointed to take possession of the property and sell it immediately, and that an injunction was to issue to prevent Ms. Kelly from being able to enter her own home. These things are irreconcilable. with the agreement that the parties reached. An injustice was done here, and we ask you to correct it.
Counsel, given the court's later findings that Ms. Kelly was complicit in the fraudulent activity, doesn't this result in a windfall to her? I mean, especially since the court specifically said that, you know, it was Mr. Gordon's property that was used to purchase the Virginia property.
First, I would ask you to disregard those findings because those were made at a hearing for which she did not have notice or opportunity to be heard.
Well, she had an opportunity. I mean, the court offered to essentially conduct a new hearing, and she declined that opportunity.
She did, again, because she had reached a settlement agreement that disposed of her risk in the case. The court was offering to essentially disregard the settlement agreement and proceed to a hearing as if the claims against her had not been settled, putting her at risk of whatever judgment the court saw fit to enter. She wisely decided to stick with the agreement that she had negotiated and reached, which she reached for the express purpose of avoiding the risk.
So you're saying she chose not to have her hearing that the court offered her?
She did.
So doesn't that extinguish any due process claim?
No, it does not.
Why not?
Because the fact that she decided to stick with the settlement agreement does not mean that she was afforded adequate process at a hearing that made findings against her. Those findings should be disregarded. What should happen here is the settlement agreement should be enforced as written. If it's declared to be ambiguous, and we don't think it is, then it should be remanded for a hearing on the party's intent in order to interpret the settlement agreement. But it certainly shouldn't be vitiated by judicial order, and she should be required to go through a hearing on the merits of the claims that she had settled. This settlement agreement has force and effect, and it should be honored by this court, even though it was disregarded by the court below. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel. I thank both counsel for their fine arguments. You've given us a lot of things to think about, and the case is now submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.